The League of New York Theaters and Producers welcomes you to Footlights, the 32nd annual presentation of the American Theater Wing's Tony Awards, brought to you live from the Schubert Theater in New York City.
Welcome back to My Little Tonys.
Hello, welcome.
We're going to talk in our creepy telephone voices the whole time.
I'm already very scared.
Anyway, so today we're talking about the 1978 Tony Awards. And, you know, after our previous go-rounds with the 70s, I was very nervous going into this because the 70s have just been, like, the strangest and worst Tony Awards. But I actually thought this was, like, maybe one of my favorites. I thought all the performances were good. I thought all the speeches were good. I thought there was just the right amount of weird stuff in it. And it was very short.
Yeah, I think my initial reaction was like, do the presenters know what they're supposed to be doing? Because between Baryshnikov and Robert Guillaume, I was like, these men don't know. It's like they just wandered on stage. But it was kind of charming.
I loved it.
Yeah.
So they were on June 4th, 1978, and they were broadcast by CBS from the Schubert Theater. And this was actually the first CBS Tonys, and they had been on ABC up until then. And obviously, you know, they've continued to be on CBS since then.
Yeah, and I think that what's interesting is that it did move networks, but it still had the same producer. I think at this point, Alexander Cohen had been producing them for the past 11 years. So we can thank him for the totally bizarre 1974 ceremony.
Yeah, the 1974 ceremony. So most of these 70s Tonys are about an hour and a half. For some reason, that one is nearly 3 hours long. So I we'll see what happens when we get there. But we got to, you know, drink our electrolytes before we dig into that one. So I think the weirdest element of, finally, they figured out that they should have the best musical nominees perform. So that was good. That was a big step forward.
I think the funny thing about that, though, is they're like, and the best musical nominees and the act, which is none.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to get Liza up there in her little sparkly suit.
Yeah, it's true.
And she ended up winning Best Actress. So, like, I think, you know, that performance was justified. So the nominees for Best Musical that year were On the 20th Century, which had 9 nominations and 5 wins. Dancin', which had 7 nominations and 2 wins. Ain't Misbehavin', which had 5 nominations and 3 wins. And Runaways, which had 5 nominations and 0 wins. So the framing device for this ceremony was so strange, but I was kind of obsessed with it. It's basically, it's so hard to communicate it through just like through audio, because it was basically just like Bonnie Franklin was narrating in her seat, but it was like she wasn't talking. They had like pre-recorded her voiceover, and it was her being like tracing her journey as an actor like over the course of the night. And she just is kind of like looking into the camera, giving like these weird little like smiles and sort of thinking faces. And just like, I couldn't tell if she felt embarrassed. It kind of seemed like she did. And all the people around her are kind of like, what is going on?
Yeah, it was very like Valley of the Dolls.
Yes, but you know what? I loved it. I felt like it didn't take up too much time. It was very you. When we were talking about this before we were recording, you called it very like David Lynch, yeah. Which I think there really was a David Lynch element to this ceremony, which I'm all about.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny because like the theme this year was Footlights, which is like people's like first memories of like seeing a play or like being
on
stage, I guess.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of vague and pretty much the theme of every year.
Although I want to call out Carol Channing coming in towards the end of the night really brought an element of chaos that I just absolutely love from her. I feel like I need to cut in her entire segments because she introduced 2 awards, and then her like her monologue she gave had nothing to do with the awards. It was her talking about Broadway at the Grammys.
In 1964, Hello Dolly won the Grammy as the best song of the year. Now, I want to make a point, or I would not be so tacky as to mention another award on this program. But did you ever stop to think how many of these best songs over the years came from Broadway musicals. Now, in 1959, there was Mack the Knife from Threepenny Opera. And in 1962, there was What Kind of Fool Am I from Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. And in 1975, we had Send in the Clowns from Little Night Music. And in 1969, there were two songs from Hair, Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In. Now, wasn't that nice for the theater?
Yes. And then Broadway shows that had been turned into movies, and her, for the ones that had turned into movies, it was like this creepy little nursery, like nightmare nursery rhyme.
There was Oklahoma and Carousel, Flower Drum Song and The King and I, South Pacific, The Sound of Music, and you know who those are all by. Rodgers and Hammerstein, of course, they wrote some of the best. Then there was Wonderful Town and The Music Man and The Side of the Street That Was West. There's Camelot Carnival and Can Can and Kismet, but that's spelled with a K. Sweet Charity, Man of La Mancha, Oliver and Cabaret. Porgy and Bess and Showboat and Annie Gets Your Gun have melodies we're all still singing. And that reminds me of Funny Girl and Hello Dolly and Fiddler on the Roof. Guys and Dolls and Mame and My Fair Lady to add to the proof. With Finian's Rainbow and Brigadoon and Our Hair and Grease and The Wiz, we think that films are just super, but we also think here's where it is. And we want to say to the movies, no matter how far you may roam, you're always welcome. Come back to the stage. Just think of this as home. Just having a little fun. Oscar, Tony loves you.
She's a blessing and a curse.
She's such an important person to me. Like, you know, I like wouldn't be surprised. I mean, obviously it was scripted, but I wouldn't be surprised if she just like came out there and was just saying whatever she wanted.
And for like those of you who, I feel like Bonnie Franklin is not a name that I was super familiar with at the time. And we get this in her little backstory that she gives. She kind of was like the breakout star of Applause a few years before this Tony's. And then at the time of the ceremony, she was the star of the Norman Lear sitcom One Day at a Time.
I remember so well when the song I sang in the Broadway musical Applause was used as the opening number on the Tonys.
What is it that we're living for? Applause, applause. Nothing I know brings on the glow like sweet applause.
Oh, that was 1970. I'd been nominated as the Best Supporting Actress in a Musical that year. It was a night I will never forget Melba Moore won. I didn't. Chubby, freckle-faced Bonnie Franklin from Hermosa Beach, California had been on the Tonys. Could there be more? Uh-huh. A television series. But of course, I didn't know that then. You see, that was the dream for many of us, to do live theater, but also to appear in motion pictures and in television.
And one of the reviews said, and the biggest mistake of the evening featured Bonnie Franklin live in the theater, squirming in what can only be called thrilled embarrassment as pre-recorded films traced her theatrical career.
That reviewer was in a bad mood, I think, because he was just like, and like, it's kind of disgusting that like Liza Minnelli is like channeling her mom's performance of Get Happy.
Yeah. And it's like, what, you know, she looks and sounds a lot like Judy. Like, what do you want her to do?
Yeah.
Leave Liza alone. Liza seemed like she was having some issues. Like her performance was great, but she, you know.
I think this was one of the first dark days of her life.
Oh, Liza. A couple, just like for the season in general. First of all, like when we sort of pick like what years we're going to do, it's somewhat random. And going through this, we found that these like connect in a really beautiful way. And also like ones we have coming up. It's really fun to see, you know, like Richard Maltby Jr. Like last year, we just saw him, you know, really at the bottom with the flop of Big. And now he's like on top again, directing Ain't Misbehavin'. So for this episode, we're going to talk about, this season was really heavy on the reviews versus book musicals. So we're going to talk about Ain't Misbehavin', which won Best Musical. Dancin', also a lot of shows with apostrophes. And there's Runaways, and then a little bit about Working, which did not get nominated for Best Musical. And I think in this season, we're really seeing the effect of like the post-Chorus Line boom, where we're seeing a lot of like plotless reviews, and we're also seeing a lot of documentary style musicals, which I think like is an influence that I didn't necessarily realize how many, I don't want to say like copycats, because I think these shows like Working and Runaways really have their own merits in some ways beyond a Chorus Line, but like that it did sort of lead to this own little micro genre of musical theater.
Yeah. And something that I was interested and surprised by, well, I feel like A Chorus Line feels like the obvious sort of like precursor to Working and Runaways. But it was interesting in the John Bush Jones, Our Musical Ourselves, he kind of like made a broader connection where Hair and Working are kind of like the bookends of this like, you know, 11 show period. He called them like fragment musicals rather than like concept musicals, because they kind of like have these fragmented pieces. I think, and I agree with this, where, you know, the idea of like a concept musical or the term is like a little confusing, because it is like, well, every show should have a, like, if you're directing a show, like it should have like a concept. He also says that like, the concept musical, it originates potentially with Martin Gottfried's review of Zorba, directed by Hal Prince in 1968. But with that being put aside, he writes, America suffered a mood swing from public political engagement to personal concerns. As Myron A. Marty notes, by the 1970s, even those sympathetic with the radicals' goals charged them with being infatuated with finding themselves, leading to a culture of narcissism. Alan Matsuyao observed the same in mainstream America when in the early 1970s, social discipline was eroding so rapidly that fashion condemned the whole of middle-class culture as the culture of narcissism. Thus, the me generation evolved from what had begun as healthy, perhaps necessary introspection, but among many, this inward turning became a kind of hedonistic narcissism. Fragmented musicals spoke directly to this self-absorption by depicting characters either asking, who am I, or alternately proclaiming their self-worth. In both the self-questioning and self-proclaiming, it's the feeling of the individual as an individual that matters.
Interesting. So
I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like when you think of like Hair, Company, Follies, Runaways, Working, A Chorus Line, Godspell, even like Pippin, I think it kind of creates this like interesting thing of these musicals that are have been kind of lumped into like a group called like concept musical, but like when in fact the concept of maybe all of them is that they kind of focus on the individual, and or this like cultural kind of like shift towards narcissism after like the, you know, the heydays of like the 60s.
I can see that argument. I do feel like, especially these shows in particular, do like, they're, you know, they're using the individual as a lens to examine like larger societal concerns.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one other thing worth noting is that our friend Sondheim, who was the president of the Dramatists Guild, wrote an open letter to the Tony producers saying that they would stop supporting them because prime television time was devoted to the bestowing of the theater's highest honor upon 8 actors, 2 directors, a choreographer, and countless producers, while as for the authors, playwrights, librettists, composers, and lyricists, not one was allowed to stand alone on the stage in front of millions of Americans to acknowledge the honor. So basically, he was trying to stand up for the writers, and the producers were kind of like tough titty. But you know, this has been this has been something that they've gone back and forth on for years. And the other thing was that it was kind of a light season.
Yeah.
And this season, only 13 musicals and 28 plays open, whereas the season before, it was 22 musicals and 35 plays.
But with that being said, this was like financially a record-breaking season. And like part of that was due to increased ticket prices. And also like still there were some long-running hits. Like you still have your Grease, your A Chorus Line, your Annie, like packing in the people. So also with that being said, what I think was interesting was that for Best Actress in a Musical, and I guess this kind of goes back to the point of what we were saying earlier about these shows where like a lot of characters are able to share the spotlight. For the 4 spots of Best Actress in a Musical, there were 5 people who were actually eligible, which is kind of funny.
You know, you might as well just get them all in there.
Who is the fifth?
I don't know. We should have figured that out before this.
Maybe it was Angel.
It's hard because, you know, there are so many ensemble pieces like, you know, Ain't Misbehavin', Dancin', Runaways, and Working. It's like, I think everybody in there would count as a supporting actor or actress. Mm-hmm. So let's do Ain't Misbehavin', which subtitle is The New Fats Waller Musical Show. And it opened May 9th, 1978, closed February 21st, 1982, after 1,604 performances. Music by Thomas Fats Waller, featuring songs by many other people with lyrics by a lot of other people also. Based on an idea by Richard Maltby Jr. and Murray Horwitz, conceived and directed by Richard Maltby Jr. and musical staging by Arthur Feria. Synopsis: The inimitable Thomas Fats Waller rose to international fame during the golden age of the Cotton Club and that jumpin' new beat, swing music. Although not quite a biography, Ain't Misbehavin' evokes the delightful humor and infectious energy of this American original as a versatile cast struts, strums, and sings the songs that he made famous in a career that ranged from uptown clubs to downtown Tin Pan Alley to Hollywood and concert stages in the US, Canada, and Europe. So this gets grouped in. This was kind of like a trend that was happening around this era where there were a lot of these kind of like jukebox reviews of like Harlem Renaissance writers or slash performers like Bubbling Brown Sugar, UB, Sophisticated Ladies. But this was the one that really had like the record breaking run.
And I think that like why I was kind of curious, like why this was so successful. And like, I think that I guess UB was not technically in this like Tony cycle. I think it might have opened a little too late to be eligible. I think that they were getting compared a lot. I think the subtext of this conversation that I think suggests why maybe Ain't Misbehavin' was so successful is that, like, rather than just like having the music there, like, I think it was really about bringing like the energy and kind of like world of Fats Waller onto the stage. Also, while there is like no narrative to it, like watching some of these like dance numbers, like there is narrative in it, and I think that like it feels like a train, you know, like the momentum behind it is so, I feel like I was watching it for 20 minutes without even like really realizing like what was going on.
Yeah, it goes down very smooth. I thought that this little segment from the review, so it started at Manhattan Theater Club. So I thought this little segment was a nice little distillation of what was special about Fats Waller. Fats Waller combined so many distinctive talents that to try to bring them all together in a brief 2-hour presentation and stamp them with his boisterous personality is like trying to catch the rainbow in a cup. He was a superb pianist, a versatile and fluent composer of popular songs, and he was a brilliant entertainer. A singer who could breathe life into the worst dog of a tune, leader of an infectiously swinging instrumental group, and possibly the only musician who has played jazz credibly on a pipe organ. And I really recommend, like, there are, you know, he did appear in a handful of movies that, you know, there are clips on YouTube, and he really is a very compelling and interesting performer.
I don't stay up late, got no place to go. I'm home about 8, just me and my radio.
Well, and it's also kind of funny because I think that my first thought was like Richard Maltby is probably like this big jazz head, but like it really actually didn't seem that way. He said that he had just only really gotten to know about Fats Waller like a year before the show opened on Broadway.
Yeah, it was his friend.
Oh yeah, Murray Horwitz, who's a great Waller buff, suggested that he do like an evening of Fats Waller, and Maltby was like, play me some. And then like from that, he just kind of hit the ground running and went to the Library of Congress and like started doing all this research. And
yeah, and it was interesting because it seemed like everyone who they were trying to get involved in the creative team, you know, it was like trying to get someone to convert to Judaism. Like they turned it down 3 times, then they were like, okay, I'll do it. The choreographer, the musical director, they were kind of like, why? And then they were like, all right, let's do it.
Yeah, well, that's also a funny thing is that in Our Musicals Ourselves, he points out that like part of why Ain't Misbehavin' was more successful than UB was that there were so many African-American creatives on the creative team that like actually like really got it in like a way that didn't feel forced or fake.
Yeah. Although I did feel uncomfortable with how often they talked about Arthur Faria. They talk about how his choreography style is oriental, which would not fly today. Another thing that was a frequent theme that I did not like, and maybe, you know, that comes with the territory when you're working on a musical about someone whose nickname was literally Fats, but there is a lot of bad body talk, mm-hmm. you know, talking about the performers where they're like, you know, the most important part of misbehaving is you got one thin girl and two fat girls.
It's like,
like a fat guy and a thin guy. They talk about it a lot. They even have an interview with Armelia McQueen, and the whole interview is basically just like interviewing about her career through the lens of like being fat. And it's like, get a grip, you guys.
So anyway,
I'm not going to pull all these examples because they're not very nice, but the way they talk about their bodies in the reviews, the way they, you know, it's just like...
Yeah, it's like totally crazy.
Yeah, it's very, you know, objectifying. And I mean, I think, you know, like Fats Waller's body size was obviously a part of his performance persona, but it borders on the unnecessary here.
Yeah, it like feels... Especially in like a post-Chorus Line era, to like be like, oh, you know what the performers definitely need to hear is like how their bodies are fucked up, or like how their bodies don't correspond to like what I think that their body should look like.
Or it's like how, you know, their bodies are ripe for comedy.
Yeah.
And like the Armelia McQueen interview ends with her being like, yeah, you know, I guess like Nell Carter got the Tony nomination. Like Nell Carter and Charlaine Woodard both got Tony nominations and Armelia McQueen didn't. She was like, yeah, you know, I guess they only wanted to nominate one fat girl.
Oh,
we forgot to do, damn it, we already forgot to do the awards.
Oh.
So it was nominated for Best Musical, Best Featured Actress in a Musical for Nell Carter and Charlaine Woodard, Best Choreography and Best Direction, and it won Best Musical. Nell Carter won Best Featured Actress, and it won Best Direction of a Musical.
Which I think were all fair wins.
I agree. And I really thought all of the speeches were excellent this go around. And I liked Richard Maltby Jr. actually brought up something that we talked about last time.
Exactly.
With, you know, how he felt like the ensemble of Ain't Misbehavin' should have been rewarded with a special Tony.
Yeah, he calls it out in his speech.
Lastly, the extraordinary, truly extraordinary cast of Ain't Misbehavin', particularly Armelia McQueen, Ken Page, and Andre DeShields, who were not nominated, but who are part of a wonderful ensemble. Someday I would like the Tony Committee to find some way to honor what I consider the highest achievement in the theater, the collective effort of an ensemble of actors.
And Nell Carter also is like, you know, I'd share this with my fellow cast members.
Then I have to say thank you to my cast, because I didn't do this by myself. I really did. I didn't expect. I didn't even come to. Oh God. I want to thank Amelia McQueen, Charlaine Woodard, Andre DeShields, Ken Page, our director, the producers, the Schuberts, Manny, everybody. Oh, thank you so much.
And I mean, I think this show is one that it's like you really can't single one person out. And actually, people have said that like when it came back in the 80s with the original cast, like now that Nell Carter was a star, it was like totally imbalanced. Like it wasn't a real ensemble anymore.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, I guess that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But even in the review, like in the Times review of the Broadway production, like I feel like unfairly Andre DeShields and Charlaine Woodard are like singled out, being like, I feel like the reviewer was like trying to like put ensemble members against each other.
Yeah, although overall, you know, it got pretty much unanimous raves.
Yeah, even in that profile of Maltby, they were like, he's like sitting at Sardi's with like 30 reviews in front of him, all raves.
Yeah, looking dazed.
Mm-hmm. Also, this like makes a lot more sense to me why he like mentored George Wolfe and like what that relationship was like. Because it was like after like last season being like, oh, he wrote Baby and Big the musical. Like, of course, like George Wolfe, you know, but like, you know, seeing Jelly's Last Jam probably, you know, like owes something to how this was originally conceived. Like it all makes a lot of sense.
And I mean, it is funny that he ended up directing Fosse, like seeing him directly up against Fosse here in Danson. And actually, the number that they perform for Danson is the same. They perform an exact recreation of it at the Tonys on the year that Fosse won.
Oh, so really?
It's very like, yeah, it's pretty, you know, the circle of life.
Mm-hmm. I think that this has probably been like a little more common with plays. Like, I think that, you know, we definitely see it in even like contemporary playwrights like Lynn Nottage and Paula Vogel, that like this like idea of like research and information like being part of like modern theater. Like, I think that it's much more common to see it in straight plays, but I think it's cool to like see musicals that do have a historic kind of research element to it and like bringing in different textures.
I agree. I have one more I mean, not necessarily one more, but I don't think there's too much more to talk about with this, but I found a review. So around this time, there was like a renewed interest in Fats Waller, and like some of his recordings were released that had been previously unreleased. And someone, there was a review in the Times, like reviewing those recordings and also reviewing the Ain't Misbehavin' cast recording. And they had a very interesting take, which was basically like without the performance element in it and just having it on CD, like, or, you know, LP, like they should have just released the original Fats Waller recordings as the Ain't Misbehavin' cast recording, which is kind of like very hot take. Like, I kind of see where they're coming from. They're obviously not going to do that. But the fact that all this is now recording seems to take the entire Ain't Misbehavin' project one step too far. It is based on the records by Fats Waller. Turning them into live presentations involves creativity in a variety of areas. The visual aspects of a live performance can, to some extent, make up for the absence of the real Waller touch. But once the stage performances are reduced to records, they are in direct competition and contrast with the original Waller records. So instead of producing an original cast album, it might have made more sense to make the recorded version of Ain't Misbehavin' an album of the Waller records on which the show is based. You know, it's a big swing. I appreciate, you know, putting that out there.
Yeah, but that's like a bad spicy hot take.
Yeah. I mean, I like understand the logic behind it, but can you imagine how upset people would be if it was like, oh, I got the new Ain't Misbehavin' recording, but it's just Fats Waller.
That's so funny.
Not a Nell Carter in sight.
Oh my God.
And there was a cute profile of Nell Carter where she was like, my ultimate dream is to be Judy Garland without the tragedy.
Aww.
It's a good goal.
Yeah, that is a good goal.
I mean, I think that's kind of it for this, right? I thought their performance was great.
Great performance. There's also, I guess, from at some point in the 80s, the original cast had made a television movie recording of it.
Oh, yes.
Which is great. And you could watch on YouTube. Also, a very fun thing for all the American Idol heads in the audience is that Ruben Studdard and Frenchie Davis like headlined a revival of this, or a tour of this, like a little over 10 years ago. So
I remember seeing the news about that. Okay, so yeah, so the, you know, the number they did, the ladies who sing with the band / off time, they highlighted the men and then the women. It was fun. I like all of these performers are, you know, very, they really struck gold with all of them.
Yeah, no, and I think that that is in itself where casting becomes an art. Mm-hmm. I mean, when there's so little to actually work with, I think that the performers become authors of the show in their own way. And
well, and I mean, I think, you know, with the success of this, we can directly trace things like, you know, Swinging on a Star, mm-hmm. etc.
Yeah. If you were tropical and you're not just a friend, you may do fine of it.
Moving.
Yeah. Do you want to do Dancin' next?
Yeah, let's do Dancin'.
Dancin', a new musical entertainment. Opening date, March 27th, 1978. Closing date, June 27th, 1982. After 1,774 performances, it featured songs by a lot of different people, ranging from Johann Sebastian Bach, Harry Warren, Neil Diamond, Cat Stevens. If they've written a song, it was in this. And it was directed and choreographed by Bob Fosse with additional choreography by Christopher Chadman. And really, this doesn't even have as much as Ain't Misbehavin', but a synopsis would be: this anthology of dance vignettes using a wide variety of styles, existing songs, and no book is directed and choreographed by Bob Fosse. And that's all you need to know.
It's all true. I think this was a couple of things. I think this was Fosse being like, I'm sick of, you know, having to try to dominate like songwriters and book writers and, you know, I can be fully in control. And this was also like the sort of checkmate in his feud with Michael Bennett, where he was like, people think A Chorus Line's about dancing, but they're just like talking and singing and not really dancing at all. Mm-hmm. This is going to be about dancing.
And I guess also on that connection, before I forget, Wayne Cilento, who went on to, you know, become a choreographer in his own right, he choreographed Wicked. He was in the cast of both of these shows, of A Chorus Line and Dancin'. So he's the link between the feud. He's a pawn.
Wasn't he in another show this season? I was surprised. Hold on. I was like, how did that happen? Oh, yeah, he was in The Act.
Oh, really? How did he swing that?
I don't know.
Oh, he was just like one of the boys in The Act. So maybe.
It seems like it did overlap, though. So I don't know. So everyone was kind of like, you know, the dancing is good, but like you need to have it be like in service of something. Like dancing for dancing's sake is kind of just like, it's exciting on sort of like a technical level, but it's not serving like a plot and characters. It's kind of like there's really nothing to build on. So the New York Times review said, Dancin', which opened last night at the Broadhurst Theater, is designed by its creator, Bob Fosse, to be a musical show purely and simply about dancing. There is no story uniting its dozen principal numbers, and each number itself has no more than a theme or rudimentary skit to hang its dancing upon. Mr. Fosse is one of the architects and craftsmen of the dance style of American musicals. It's a style that possesses many qualities, and many of them are evident in this show. The genre has wit, excitement, impudence, and gaiety, but it lacks the intensity, the seriousness to be its own bones. It can give color and flavor, but it needs words, music, a plot, even silly plot, to carry it. It does not seem able, judging by this attempt anyway, to be its own structure. So, you know, I think that's fair.
It's also kind of funny because, like, another thing about the review is Anne Rankin did get called out in a good way. She received the praise that she deserved.
I love Anne Rankin. She, like, I was just watching Annie this week because I was very stressed out, and she was really, like, one of my very early crushes, her in that movie.
Aww.
She's just so beautiful.
She is. But it's kind of funny because, like, while Bob Fosse is, like, being a tyrant and being like, I want to be the only creative person, like, he has Gwen Verdon working on this show. He has Anne Rankin, who's like, you know, both of them are like his slave wives. And then he also asked Graziella Danielle to like contribute to it, and she was like, nah, I'm good. Like, you know, if you run out of ideas, call me, but like, I'm not trying to get in you to chew off my head.
Yeah, he was having a hard time during this process.
I've worked on a lot of shows, and I think I've had the most fun I ever had in my life in working on Dancing. And for those who know something about me, that means I was just merely depressed and not suicidal.
So, you know, just like putting it together, it was incredibly physically demanding. One of the dancers said it was like playing the Super Bowl every single day. And like the dressers would literally like lay out lines of coke in the quick change stations for the dancers just so they could get through it.
Oh my God, that's insane.
I know. And he was like, during the rehearsal process, he was like playing everyone against each other. So, because they were trying to, you know, fight it out to get like the best numbers. Because it's like, there's no plot. So it's like, there's nothing dictating who gets what material and like whatever. So it was really only just like his whims and how he felt about you on that day.
One
of the dancers came in like a sexy like skin tight bodysuit, and he was like, if you'd worn that in your audition, you'd have like the biggest number in the show.
Wow.
It's like, Fosse,
talk about a culture of narcissism.
I know. He never learned anything. There was a really interesting profile of Jules Fisher, who, did he win Best Lighting?
Yeah, he won Best Lighting for this.
So he's someone who's worth calling out as a craftsman. Mm-hmm. He's still, oh, and he's married to Graziella
Danielle. Yeah, exactly,
yeah. So he's 82 years old. He's been working, you know, for 50 years. He's been nominated
20 times.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the absence of something like the PBS section, hearing him, like, describe the craft of lighting, of stage lighting, I thought was very beautiful. What is important to Mr. Fisher is that the lighting be exactly right for each moment of the play, that it enhance the playwright's meaning, that it elucidate the drama. Lighting is not used to provide visibility. Although visibility is a very important factor in lighting, it's the least important as far as aesthetics go. You can put light on the stage to see the performer, yes. If it's too dark and the audience can't see an actor's lips, then they don't hear very well. Anyone can put a light bulb on stage, but lighting design is selecting what the audience will see at each moment. Good lighting design gives the audience a sense of emotional involvement with the play. I try to find the emotional content of each piece, what the primary movement is, small or large, hips or whatever. Bob's choreography very frequently consists of small physical movements, movements of the wrist, movements of the pelvis, movements of fingers. So I had to find a way to show these fine details. If you have a little bit of light, you'll be able to see a person leap across the stage. But if you want to see the person crook a little finger, you have to have a lot of light or very specific light. In dancing, there are light sources from multiple directions just to show an arm movement or a hand movement. As complex as the technical aspects of theatrical lighting seem, what separates Mr. Fisher from other lighting designers is not his ability to focus lights or to interpret visions of directors and choreographers. Rather, it is his personal relationship to the quality of the light around him and the effect that quality has on his world. Mr. Fisher is amazed by light and spends a better part of his life analyzing it. He carries a camera with him to record and to experiment with what he sees, and his office walls hold photos of the effects of varying sources of light. There are trees black against a wash of sunlight, and the same trees eerily fading into their light source. There's another photo of three orange peels, lighted in such a manner that they appear as strange objects out of the mind of a science fiction writer. To reveal the changing, evolving emotional context in a performer's words and movement, Mr. Fisher said, the lighting must be ever-changing, synchronized, and subtly harmonious. If we're to believe that the action we're seeing on stage is alive, is real, then the light must follow. It must get brighter, must get darker, must change in color, must change in value. It must breathe. So I thought that was really beautiful. Wait, you know, yeah. Like there, it really is. I don't think lighting design is often acknowledged as like, you know, I think it's often seen as like a technical skill rather than an art. So I thought, you know, yeah. It was nice to hear it described in that way.
And I think that like there at varying times there have been like comments about like directors kind of theater directors bringing like a cinematic like element to the stage, or you know, I think someone definitely like Hal Prince or even like Sam Mendes, like you really feel like there's like this like cinematic quality to like their directing style. But like I think that especially like the aspect of him using photography to like capture light, I think that this feels like the art form probably being a lighting designer owes more to like cinematography than like being a theater director does, in my opinion.
Totally. And I think, you know, the relationship between like a film director and a cinematographer is similar to the relationship between like a theater director and the lighting designer.
Yeah, totally. Also, I thought what was interesting in that profile is that when he was a kid, he was like a magician. And they're like, he still like practices magic on the side, but aww. I mean, it makes a lot of sense if you're like into, you know, I feel like it's on the same wavelength.
Yeah. And I mean, he's someone whose name I feel like we see come up pretty much every year. So it's nice to have a little peek into his process.
Yeah. And he's won a total of 9 Tonys, more than any other lighting designer.
He also makes a cameo as himself in All That Jazz doing the lighting design.
Aww. It's also kind of crazy that he's, like, still kicking.
Yeah, he just did Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus last year.
But it's crazy because his first show was Anyone, or I guess his selected first show, he, you know, he choreographed Anyone Can Whistle, I guess, is all I'm going to say.
Or he did the lighting design.
Yeah, that's exactly what it meant.
There was a Fosse profile.
Before you get into that, I will say that the person who wrote the profile said, Mr. Fosse doesn't exactly radiate health under the best circumstances. He is too pale and thin for that. But the strain of preparing his unorthodox Broadway musical, where it opens tomorrow at the Broadhurst, showed in his eyes.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess he was, you know, still 10 years away from his death, but yeah, they were basically like, you know, he was not sleeping for days and days at a time. Mr. Fosse himself is uncomfortable with the idea that he has created anything so formal or frozen as a style. I've really tried to vary my choices to try to get rid of whatever it is that people call my style, he said. And when you think about it, what are they talking about? Characteristics. I use a lot of hats, I suppose, but I started wearing hats because I started losing my hair. I'd wear one to a rehearsal and start doing tricks with it, so that became part of my style. Also, I have bad posture. Look, he said, standing up to demonstrate. A lot of my stuff comes out rounded over this way, and I don't have a natural turnout, he added, pointing down at his booted feet. In fact, I'm slightly turned in, so a lot of the steps I do are that way too. He did a quick pigeon-toed shuffle. See, and the jerkiness of what they call my style is, well, I guess the jerkiness is just me. Then the famous Fosse style is just a simple translation of the Fosse physique. You mean Fosse's handicaps, he said, laughing. Given what I am, I guess I had no other way to go, did I? So, you know, I think that's something that people, I don't know if that's like any big revelation, but it's a very concise way of putting it. And he also talks about, in later on in the profile, he talks about wishing that all of his shows could have been filmed. No one, it was clear, could reconstruct a Bob Fosse dance from the notes in those composition books. The impermanence of his work depresses him. I think all these shows should be filmed or videotaped for the future, he said. Even the musicals that finally get made into movies are so bastardized by the process that it just isn't the same thing anymore. Some of my best work I'll never see again. There's just no way of reconstructing it. Look at what's gone. Great work by Agnes DeMille, Jerry Robbins. I owe a lot to Jerry. His work was a great inspiration to me, things like Fancy Free and Interplay, and I'm mad about Agnes's stuff.
Well, I guess what's so funny about that is that in 1978, in June of this year, was when American Dance Machine, they played on Broadway briefly, which was like a project by Lee Theodore, who was like a Broadway performer. She was the original Anybody's in West Side Story.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, and she started this like living archive of Broadway theater dance where, you know, they would get people who were in the original productions to like come back and like reconstruct things. And I mean, like, maybe he's right. Maybe like you'll never actually get it, but you know, it's pretty close. I think it's also cool. And like, I think it's cool that it's like conceived as like a living archive, because like I think that in a lot of ways these performances were filmed themselves, so like I guess it's kind of like if you photocopy it enough times, like maybe it does lose something, but I think right. That like so much of the thrill of it is seeing it live, and totally. Like you lose so much of it by it being recorded,
you know. It there's just like no way to preserve dance the way that you can like preserve a libretto or like a written song, mm-hmm. You know, I think that's kind of what the struggle is, other than, you know, because he's talking about like how he has sort of like this imperfect notation system. And it's like film is really the only way to do it.
Yeah. Also, for the record, the reason I wear a hat is not because I'm losing my hair.
But that is why you incorporate it into all your dance.
Yes, exactly. I think the funniest review was someone from the Washington Post wrote a review called Dancin', Caught Between Raunch and A Hardcore. It starts with the question, have theater goers become so bored and desensitized they can no longer distinguish between obscene titillation and entertainment? And the opening spiel in Dancin', the Bob Fosse musical that opened to predominantly favorable but mixed reviews and is packing them into the Broadhurst, an offstage MC boasts that the show has the daring to consist of nothing but dancing, without the usual props of story or theme. It is true enough that the show crackles with visceral electricity, Fosse's forte, and that the dancers, with sleek, leggy, alluring, and ranking in the number one spot, toss off showers of sparks. But the real content of the show has less to do with dancing than with sanitized pornography, the kind of packaged sleaze Broadway has made into a specialized industry over the past two decades. The ability Jesus. Of an audience to enjoy such material depends on a willingness to equate theatricalized smut with sophistication.
Wow.
He is definitely...
Like, he was fed up.
Yeah, I know. He was... probably very turned on, which led him to be fed up. He's like, I'm sick of being so horny.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and we didn't do, damn it, the awards.
Oh, yeah.
We're trying so hard here. Okay, so it was nominated for Best Musical, Best Featured Actor for Wayne Cilento, Best Featured Actress for Anne Rankin, Best Costume Design, Best Lighting Design, Best Choreography, and Best Direction. And it won Lighting Design and Choreography, which again, I think, you know, mm-hmm. Can't argue with that.
I think that this has been a pretty fair Tonys so far.
Yeah, I think they were, I mean, I wish that Runaways had gotten more, but I'm also not surprised.
Yeah.
That's my only qualm.
Yes.
So this was the swing, swing, swing. No, sing, sing, sing. Benny Goodman, best known to people our age, I think, is the Chips Ahoy
yeah.
commercial song. Chips Ahoy, 1,000 chips, delicious. But yeah, I mean, I think like watching this, I sort of understand the criticism that it's kind of like, the dancing is very impressive, but it's also like, there's no there there.
Mm-hmm.
I like seeing all my friends there. Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
That's dancing. Okay, so next up we have the last Best Musical nominee we'll be talking about this week, which is Runaways. So Runaways opened May 13th, 1978, closed December 31st, 1978 after 274 performances. Music, lyrics, book, direction, and choreography by Elizabeth Suedos. Additional text contributed by assorted cast members. Runaways is a musical about the lives of children who run away from home and live on the city streets. The characters were taken from workshops conducted by Suedos with real-life runaways in the late 1970s. I think I want to open this up with Liz Suedos talking about it in her own words.
And just so everyone knows, she was 27 years old when this was going on.
Yeah, she's a very cool customer, and I'm excited to sort of dig into her because she's definitely a true, like, eccentric genius, very strange, but very New York figure. This was originally from Masterworks Broadway, which had this interview with her. Runaways was in the works for a year. When I went to Joseph Papp in May of 1977, I had no script, no songs, no storyline, just an idea and an intuition about the potential of adolescence. I wanted to make a collage about the profound effects of our deteriorating families. I wanted to explore the substitutes that people find to deal with loss of family and how these substitutes are sometimes effective and sometimes destructive. I wanted to tap the energy of young people. I have seen them excel professionally in athletics, pop, and classical music, and I knew there was a real possibility for the same excellence in the theater, beyond cutesiness and beyond cliche. From that May until the May of 1978 when we opened on Broadway, I was subsidized by the New York Shakespeare Festival and held hundreds of interviews, auditions, workshops, and rehearsals. I was uplifted by the imagination and spirit of the kids I met. I was also appalled at their potential apathy and resignation. I saw over 2,000 kids at schools, community centers, and museums over the four-month period of auditions. I was looking for individuals who were ornery, athletic, imaginative, and, if not political, somehow aware that the human race is in a mess. The cast, contrary to some reports, is not made up of scraggly runaways whom I mercifully rescued from the streets. There are runaways among them, but many of the kids are from solid or broken families. And there are three experienced actors who helped to set a certain professional standard. During the 5 months of workshops and rehearsals, I wrote hours of songs, and the company did multitudes of improvisations. There was an energy, a courage, an honesty in the kids that would constantly challenge my more cliched artistic notions. Their rhythms, the look in their eyes, their way of speaking, all had their influence on me. A lot of what I wanted to write was in my head, but much of what resulted came from the workshops. I would ask them questions and listen to their stories. I spent hours asking myself, what would be exactly the right question that would help me write? The kids could lie or they could tell the truth. I watched them, felt the pressures on them, became concerned about them. Then I would go off and suddenly there would be a song, just from having been with them. The songs on this album are the folk music of a very special tribe called the Runaways. There's no plot or storyline. Runaways is a collage of speeches and songs for their rituals. Runaways is first and foremost a celebration and a tribute to the highly unusual spirit of its young cast. I am a great admirer of any young person who is surviving in this confusing decade. I think adolescence is a time filled with incredible, blunt, curious, furious energy. Although the words and music of the piece express the pain and confusion of any runaway, child or adult, the performance of a special cast demonstrates the potential of the human spirit. So I thought that was a really good summary of what's going on here.
Yeah, no, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I think that you either hear that sort of take on it, or in some of the books that I was reading, I feel like people are like, well, it's a Liz Suedos show, which, like, is kind of a funny take that, you know, I think that, like, she's, like, a very admirable artist, but I also think that it is kind of funny that, you know, this was kind of, like, the beginning of, or, like, a kind of, like, her signature style of... Mm-hmm. Like, I'll read this little passage from Our Musicals Ourselves. For 267 performances, the kids let the audience know who they were, where they came from, and what life on the streets was like, but mostly why they ran away. But I can state from personal experience what Runaways' trouble was. On opening night, as I made my way through the packed lobby at intermission, I repeatedly heard words to the effect of, "This is so heavy-handed," and above all, "My God, this is didactic." However honestly Suedos had recorded the runaway remarks, she apparently shaped and edited their thoughts into a finger-pointing agenda, hence the multiple didactic and heavy-handed comments at the act break. In the show's simplistic and reductive thinking, the cause of the entire runaway problem boiled down simply to one thing, parents. 9 of the 21 songs and speeches in Act 1 alone, or nearly half, blamed dysfunctional families, single-parent households, divorce, and other parent-driven problems for the kids' current state as junkies, criminals, or teenage prostitutes. Right from opening night, audiences were put off by Runaways' one-dimensional approach to a very complex problem.
Well, that seems like, I don't know. I mean, I think Walter Kerr had like a similar view in his review, and actually the Times ended up publishing literally 5 letters to the editor being like, you're wrong. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's a certain amount of like maybe defensiveness watching it if you're a parent, being like, oh, sure, all these kids' problems is their parents. And it's like, yes, it is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't agree. I think that might be too reductive of a take. It's also just like the type of thing where it's like, do adults really care about kids at all?
Yeah, I mean, so like this is one of the letters to the editor. How clear it is that Mr. Kerr cannot properly evaluate the musical Runaways, since the entire work emanates from the attitudes Runaways exhibit to the adult world. If that attitude is not understood, then Runaways is not understood. Here lies the very core of the musical, the basis of the musical, the source of its music, its lyrics, its movement, and its physical and emotional attitudes. All spring from the understanding of the many ways children turn off from an intolerable adult world. In his review, Mr. Kerr clearly demonstrates his disconnection with this crucial essence, and is therefore thoroughly incapable of offering an objective view of Ms. Suedos' unique creation. Ooh. So I thought, you know, it really is like whether or not you can connect to it. And I think, like, I don't know. I felt, you know, I was surprised. Like, I had heard about this show, you know, years and years ago. And, like, I tried to listen to it, but I couldn't really get into it, I think, because I was still very, like, you know, into the idea of like the classic book musical. And when I, you know, revisited it this time, I was like, how could I not have seen what is so amazing about this show? And I was very like, I was surprised at how moved by it I was. And like, it really does tap into something, even though like the experiences in it are not universal. Like, I feel like it taps into something so real about the way that you feel when you're a teenager. Even like, I felt like, you know, compared to something like Dear Evan Hansen, which was obviously like closer to my actual teenage experience than to be like, you know, a 70s street kid. But I felt like this was so like raw and really just like it does feel really authentic.
I mean, yeah, it does. It makes for a great listen. And like, I think that this is actually something that, comparing my experience listening to the cast recording and then seeing the Tony's performance, I think that the cast recording left a better taste in my mouth.
I agree.
I feel like while Liz Suedos is an amazing Renaissance woman and can kind of get you a girl who could do it all, I think that the choreography is really cheesy.
Although it's interesting because it did incorporate, so there was a deaf actor in the cast and it incorporated a lot of sign language, which you can see in the performance. And it also felt like a real precursor to the Spring Awakening choreography. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could see that.
And it's funny because, so, you know, Encores did it a few years ago. Liz Suedos passed away before the performance, like, you know, several months before, but she was involved sort of in the early stages. And I saw a review that was like, you know, they added some updates, like adding, you know, a deaf character. And it's like, no, that was in the original. She really did innovate in ways like I can't think of any other shows that had like that used hip hop in this way. Like, unless you're counting something like The Music Man, like, I feel like this probably is the real first appearance of hip-hop on Broadway.
And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah!
Here are some of the ways we survive. Right. It's always shoplifting at the A&P. Pay for a pack of gum and steal a steak. Or insecurity is too close by.
What you gonna do?
Eat the cheese right there. I say enterprise. You got to enterprise. Enterprise. You got to enterprise.
She's just such a strange and cool figure. Like, reading about her life, even though she was only 27, she had had so many like crazy experiences and like traveled and, you know, had a lot of like death in her family. And I think by the time she died, she was like the only living member of her family.
Wow. Yeah. And she was like on a million soap operas. She
okay, wait. So that is my what? Because in her Wikipedia page, this is a something that we should not take at face value, because I think this is like the whiz thing.
Yeah.
So on her Wikipedia page, it says she made guest appearances on 11 soap operas, 4 on ABC, Loving, All My Children, One Life to Live, General Hospital, 3 on NBC, Days of Our Lives, Another World, and Santa Barbara, and 4 on CBS, The Young and the Restless, The Bold and the Beautiful, As the World Turns, and Guiding Light. So when I saw that, I was like, wait, so is she playing herself? Like, was she playing characters? Like, I want to learn more about this. There's nothing on IMDb about it. There's no references to it in any of, like, her obituaries, anything. There's no citation to it in her Wikipedia. The only other thing that mentions it is one of those websites that just, like, aggregates people's Wikipedia pages. Uh-huh. So if anyone has more information about why someone would assert this and what basis...
That's so interesting.
Right? That's like... So that's my what? Tell us more about Liz Suedos and these soap operas if you know anything.
We need a citation.
Yeah.
Also, apparently she published a novel, or a novel of hers was published in 2016 by the feminist press called Walking the Dog, that a book critic I know seemed to really love.
Ooh. Yeah, she has written a lot of books. She really is just like a, you know, true Renaissance woman. And when they cut to her at the Tonys, she is just like, just has like these huge mountains of hair. She looks like, you know, a 12-year-old like Victorian child.
Yeah, she looks like Edward Gorey. Like,
yes. She does look like an Edward Gorey illustration. But you know what is interesting is that a lot of people say that she was a real taskmaster and would like yell at them. Like, she was really hard on them during the rehearsal process. Here's a little excerpt. She did not condone laziness or indolence in any context. Mr. Papp once heard her say to a member of the cast, "Sing it louder or you'll be replaced." That threat always hung over their heads. She publicly criticized everyone from the youngest to the oldest, even including the musicians who are old friends and associates. At first, some of the youngsters would cry in response to criticism, but soon their skins got thicker. An effective actress, Miss Suedos can escalate her anger at will. In her biggest explosion, she threw her script and all of her notes into the air. And so one of the members of the cast got a job in a movie. So, matter-of-factly, he informed Miss Suedos, perhaps expecting her blessing. Instead, she exploded. He had joined the company under false pretenses, wasted months of her time, abused his relationship with the other youngsters. Feeling that the boy was remorseless and that his act was reprehensible, especially considering the time invested, she accelerated her attack until he cried. Then, tearfully, he asked if he could go to the bathroom. "It's no longer your bathroom," she said, and dismissed him from the theater. So, definitely not perfect. A pretty intense... But actually, so one of the cast members who also, you know, went on to bigger and better things was Trini Alvarado, who's heavily featured in the performance. And I think, to me, I knew her best as Meg from the Winona Ryder Little Women. Mm-hmm. When they interviewed her after Liz died, so she said, "She was like our mom and we felt so guided. We also did not want to disappoint her because she was tough. But then a year later, we were doing a workshop for a movie version that never happened. And I remember thinking, we're not doing it right. Yell at us." I think she really softened in that year after Runaways.
Oh,
so
well, good.
Some people responded to the tough love approach more than others. But I thought that was the only little tidbit about that they had like been talking about making a movie version.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because like, and the reverse of that, I feel like we're like playing like dueling Liz Suedos stories. But Janine Tesori was kind of one of the people, I guess she was the artistic director of Encore's Off Center. Before ever meeting her, Tesori witnessed the community Suedos created. "I saw her making families wherever she went. I saw people devoted to her." Tesori, a fan of Suedos's since seeing Runaways at the Public, describes her as a pioneer who fearlessly lived her creative process while creating family out of artists. "The fact that she was there doing her thing," Tesori says, "was so gratifying for me to know." Bachman, who is Suedos' assistant, tells stories of when he would arrange music based on Suedos' notes and scribbles, deciphering what she might mean in the hurried scratches of a creative mind at work. When finished, he would ask her if she would like to check his transcription, and she would reply, "I'll hear it in rehearsal." Another way in which she instilled confidence and powers in those learning at her feet.
I mean, I think she was definitely like a complicated figure and obviously inspired, like was very beloved, like inspired a lot of loyalty. But also like, I just love that she was like, I'm not going to tone down my approach just because I'm working with 9-year-olds.
Like, yeah. Well, it's kind of funny too, because I think that like, especially for a generation of like women in power, like I think that there's kind of this trope, and like I don't know how true it really is, but you know, you see it every now and then where it's like the idea of like a woman in power is like the mirror of like what it's like to be like the man, you know, like thinking of like Fosse as like, you know, his behavior reaction,
like no one bats an eyelash when
exactly
but at the same time, you know, it would be a double standard to bring up Fosse behaving that way and not, you know, to gloss over her crimes. I don't think we need to cancel her or anything.
No. But rest in power, babe.
Yeah, man. So Diane Lane was the only cast member who didn't transfer from the public, which is too bad. She sang, you know, Song of a Child Prostitute, which is one of the most intense songs in the show.
When I was a kid, my parents would check on me before they'd shoot up, and I'd pretend to be asleep. Nico says the same. Just pretend you feel good. Just pretend you feel good. Mostly everything works like clockwork, and I'll be Miko's number one girl forever. Or at least until I'm 16 and can get my learner's permit to drive to Montana to be a rancher. But for now it's not bad, it's a minute stretch. To be someone's Sally, to be someone's daughter, to be someone's sister, to pretend to be glad, to pretend to be glad.
But the other one, so I thought the Tony performance, they picked exactly the right songs. Like, that is what I would have picked. But the other, besides Lullaby from Baby to Baby, the song that actually, and I guess it's not even a song, that like impacted me the most was, I guess, like a spoken word monologue to the dead of family wars.
I say make laws against regret. Otherwise, you'd have to start with Adam and Eve. The line is long and waiting. They were unsavable by you. They were unseen by their own parents themselves. It is so long, this song, and so yearning. To boys and girls too young to know when eyes are cold and scared. To boys and girls who in baby memories remember a squeeze to stop crying so violent that it could not have meant anything but violence.
I'll be perfectly honest in saying that I love listening to all of the recordings that we're talking about today. I think that maybe Working is actually the only one that like feels like I'll like revisit certain songs. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like with Ain't Misbehavin' and Runaways, like there was just such a flow to it that like I wasn't really like noticing songs change,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But also this was the only one where, like, as soon as I finished listening to it, like, I immediately started it over again.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, we mentioned that it was produced by Encores in 2016, and they did, you know, a similar, like, casting a wide net to find, like, a really diverse and interesting group of performers. And I saw that one of the reviews actually, you know, sort of echoed what we've talked about with things like Rent and Hair, where it's, like, the original cast, like, brought so much grittiness and authenticity to it that it kind of, like, you know, no matter how talented the people are, like, no matter how strong the material is, no matter how talented the cast is, there just will always be like an X factor missing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it honestly had a pretty healthy run for being such a potentially alienating show.
Yeah.
It also feels like so, it's such a particular feeling to like see so many young people on the stage at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think like maybe they were not like playing to the camera as well as they could have in the performance, but like I thought there was still a power to it, even though it wasn't the same. It wasn't as powerful as it is on the cast recording.
Mm-hmm. Also, yeah, I wonder if like the casting of all these young people was like something that Sondheim and Hal Prince and George Firth saw, and they're like, let's do this for Merrily too.
Yeah.
Like, I just wonder, like, had there been like a show about teenagers that featured so many young people?
Annie.
Oh yeah, that's true.
This is kind of like
this is like the raunchy.
Yeah. It's like those Annie kids thought they had problems.
That's true. I mean, but there are no adults in this, right?
There are like a couple of like 20 or 21 year olds, but they're all supposed to be, you know, teenage. Yeah. And I think originally in the workshops, they did have scenes where like the kids were playing adults, and like over the course of the process, they were like, we should just focus on the kid perspective, which I think was smart. So yeah, so for their performance, they did Every Now and Then. Lullaby from Baby to Baby, which I think that's sort of like, if you take away any song from that, it should be that one. A woman gets a job in 9 to 8, money away now. Forget she was a mother and a wife. Finds herself a nice apartment and makes up for the last 35 years of her life. Because a mom has got to run from daddy. A mom has got to run from child. Trini Alvarado can really wail.
And it's funny because in that TV review we talked about at the beginning of the episode, they talked about how the Obies were televised that year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Liz got her due there.
Good. That makes sense.
She won, and they also won a Best Ensemble Award, which is good.
Yes. Let me be young before I get too old. Let me be a kid. Just let me be young before I get too old. Let me be a kid. So now we have our last show we're going to talk about this episode. Not nominated for Best Musical, but still did pretty well for itself, and that is Working.
So Working opened on May 14th, 1978, closed on June 4th, 1978.
Yeah, this is a real infamous flop. So it was 24 performances.
So it's based on the 1974 book by Studs Terkel, Working. People talk about what they do all day and how they feel about what they do. And it was adapted by Stephen Schwartz, and it was written by like a variety of songwriters, including Schwartz, but also including Craig Carnelia, Mickey Grant, who we love, Mary Rogers, who we love, James Taylor, Michelle Brewerman, Susan Birkenhead wrote some of the lyrics, and it was directed by Stephen Schwartz, and dance and musical staging by Una White. So synopsis: the hopes, dreams, joys, and concerns of the average working American are the focus of this unique, extraordinary musical. Based on Studs Terkel's best-selling book of interviews with American workers, Working paints a vivid portrait of the men and women that the world so often takes for granted. The school teacher, the parking lot attendant, the waitress, the mill worker, the mason, the trucker, the fireman, and the housewife, just to name a few. It's a highly original look at the American landscape that is simply impossible to forget.
It was nominated for Best Book of a Musical, Best Original Score, Best Featured Actor for Rex Everhart and Stephen Boekvoor, Best Scenic Design, and Best Lighting Design, and it did not win any of them. So it's funny, the impetus to make this show basically is Stephen Schwartz getting woke. And
yeah, he was just like, wait a minute, I've never had a job in my life.
Yeah. He said, I first became intrigued with Working shortly after the publication of Studs Terkel's book when I read a review which contained some excerpts. One of the excerpts was the interview with Heather Lamb, the telephone operator, who said, it's something to run into somebody who says, how's your day been, operator? Busy? Has it been a rough day? You're so thankful for those people. I realized that I was one of the other kind of people, the kind who was not only impatient with operators, but who on some level viewed them as functions rather than human beings. I suppose you could call it a consciousness-raising moment. So, you know, better late than never. Although I mean, he was 30 at this point. That's pretty late.
Yeah, he kind of had like a crazy career that, you know, basically from getting out of college, he got it done.
It's
or
true.
He had, you know, found early success. I think at this point, The Magic Show was like still running. And,
yeah.
You know, Pippin and Godspell were also huge hits and huge cast recordings.
And I mean this in a nice way, but he really comes off as such a dweeb. Like in all the, like there's this interview with him where he's like, he stressed he does not miss the social life that success in the theater can offer. I don't like it. I'm made nervous by it. Don't know how to deal with it. I hate parties, he said. All I do is sit in the corner and try to pretend I'm observing, but I'm really just sitting there mortified, not daring to speak to anyone and hoping to God that someone will speak to me, then immediately putting someone off who does. Also, I get tired early. I just can't handle that kind of life. So this was a big flop, but has had huge regional success.
Yeah, that's, you know, out of all of these shows, I mean, the numbers on it are kind of, let me find them. Conversely, Working's grassroots or populist appeal helped account for its phenomenal popularity beyond Broadway. The musical has continued to have an ongoing life in professional, regional, and college, high school, community theaters. So MTI was unable to locate numbers for 1978 through 1989, but from the period of 1990 to 2000, MTI gave permission for 351 separate American productions of Working, an average of over 35 regional productions a year, which, you know, the 10 years that they don't have the data, I mean, I would imagine there would actually be more because it was closer to its actual run.
I think its appeal is definitely understandable. And he also said, you know, going off of his like consciousness raising moment, he said, when people leave the theater, I want the experience of, say, getting their car from the parking lot to be different than it was when they left their car there. I would like them suddenly to take a look at that parking lot attendant and later the guy who gives them a restaurant check and the girl who hands them their coats and the people who's sell them Subway tokens and start to look at them for a moment and start to realize what the connections are.
Well, I think that that's kind of the interesting thing is because the actual Working book is huge and full of so many jobs, but like the types of jobs, I think with like the exception of maybe like a few, I think the one that comes to mind is like the teacher. Like they're all like very like blue collar jobs, like the types of jobs that are the people who like quote like society doesn't see. Mm-hmm. So I think that is kind of interesting that his decision to like focus on that, those kinds of interviews from the original book.
Yeah. I mean, he did say that was like what moved him about it was realizing that there was this whole class of people that he was overlooking personally. Being like, wait a minute. And I think what is interesting is that this show has been revised like a handful of times over the years. Over the years, they've sort of taken out jobs that don't really exist anymore, like the paper boy and like, you know, the guy who reads the gas meter. This is for the 2012 rewrite. So the writers have updated the material to acknowledge changes in working conditions and high unemployment. More tasks have become automated, more jobs have been outsourced, and many artisanal skills have faded into obsolescence. Occupations like hedge fund manager, tech support assistant, and philanthropic fundraiser are now incorporated, though these elements are frequently given patronizing handling that seems out of character with Turkle's non-judgmental project. And then it was also like Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote two new songs more recently.
Yeah, no, I think that it is cool that there is like a potential to kind of bring new things in. And I also think that part of that too is like owed to the fact that there were so many different songwriters working on it.
Yeah.
Which I think is cool.
I do too. And I mean, I think some people saw that as a weakness that it was kind of patchwork and like there was such a huge difference in quality, like a very wide range of quality in the songs. One other thing, I thought a cute update they did. So they did it for Encores in 2019, which was the 75th anniversary of City Center. So they added like a few new monologues where they interviewed different people who worked at City Center, like ticket takers, box office staff, and security, and like incorporated these new characters.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Did you see it?
No, but this, I mean, doing this year is like, why didn't I go to this and run away?
So I think that like the cool thing, or one of the cool things, is seeing our old friend Mickey Grant.
Yeah.
Because I guess Schwartz had been like, oh, you know who I really like admire? Mickey Grant. Like, I love Don't Bother Me, I Can't Cope. So he like basically like went up to her apartment and was like, oh, how do I write songs like Mickey Grant? And he was like, rather than trying to do it, like, I might as well just ask her. So he like signed her onto it. And then, you know, he wrote to like a bunch of different people. Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon declined. I think James Taylor is probably like the biggest outsider star who worked on it. He says he regrets not asking Billy Joel.
Well, I think, you know, that's like a very magnanimous thing of him to do, is to be like, having these different perspectives will be helpful.
Yeah, he's like, well, how do I rip off a woman of color? I mean, that's like really how most people would do it.
Yeah. And I think the James Taylor song, sometimes it's called Mill Work and sometimes it's called Mill Worker, but I think that has been singled out as the best song in the score. And it became like, he recorded it as a single. I think a lot of people have covered it maybe not knowing its origin in this show.
It's my life has been wasted, and I have been a fool to let this manufacturer use my body for a tool. I get to ride home in the evening, staring at my hands, swearing by my sorrow that a young girl ought to stand a better chance.
It's kind of funny, too, because Studs Terkel, like, had, like, a radio show in Chicago for, like, a really long time and, like, was kind of, like, a Chicago celebrity. And I feel like the production that took place in the out-of-town tryout in Chicago was kind of, like, seen as this, like, Studs moment to, like, honor, like, a, you know, city
hometown hero.
Yeah, but then like all the like bitchy like New York theater critics were like, oh great, Clive Barnes wrote Ambivalence, here we come.
Oh boy. Well, I think it's, you know, eventually over time it's had its moment to shine.
And may I work this mill just as long as I am able, and never meet the man whose name is on the label. It's me and my machine for the rest of the morning, for the rest of the afternoon gone, and the rest of my life.
Okay, so yeah, so that's it. For next time, we are going to... So we kind of tried to split this up into like reviews and non-reviews, but there were a lot of... Or not reviews, but like book musicals and not. So next time we're going to talk about On the 20th Century, which is, I think, the closest thing we have to a traditional musical in this category. We also have Timbuktu, which is a very unique case of a musical revival that was... totally revised and has a different title than the original. We're going to talk about some plays. Oh yeah, The Act, which I thought, you know, initially I assumed it was a book musical, but I think it is more of like Eliza Showcase.
Yeah, but I'm actually excited. I feel like we haven't seen our good friends Cantor and Ebb in a while.
I know, and our good friend Liza. So until then, you can email us at mylittletoniespodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can... rate and review on Apple Podcasts, even though I will not be looking at them anymore because they hurt my feelings sometimes. You can become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/mylittletonies. All right. See you next week.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Another 100 people just got off of the train and came up through the ground, while another 100 people just got off of the bus and are looking around at another 100 people who got off of the plane and are looking at us who got off of the train and the plane and the bus. Maybe yesterday. Maybe yesterday.